Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at Revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The ground is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
Think of me as an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Your systems are offline. Mario!
Do it live! I can all write it and we'll do it live!
What the hell's going on out here?
Ladies and gentlemen, here it is. Because there's no one else like you left.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on the leaving. That you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough at life.
Five 03 Central, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast, 603 East Coast. Good Tuesday morning, Pack Woman, as you wander through the nude beaches of Australia. Good evening, Christine C. Caught your show as you wander through your parts naked. Happy evening, Iceland. As we welcome you once again to the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday evening here on Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, common spelling in your favorite internet browser, where we are broadcasting live from the home location in the great state of Minnesota, where nothing is allowed. The forecast this evening, my fine feathered friends, a balmy 78 degrees, although it's cooling down now at night, mid-50s. But next week, the heat wave comes back. That's the thing about Minnesota, kids. You know, there's heat waves and yellows and reds across the parts of the contiguous 48. But Minnesota's an odd state, boys and girls. It's an odd state. January, February, we could have consistent days of a high of 30 below Fahrenheit. March, it's crazy. April, it's crazy. Then the dog days of summer. So from mid-June all the way through August, you could have a day where it's 73 and nice and a little breezy outside. Next day, you know, 95 and humid. It's the craziest state in the contiguous 48. Apparently, we've got some Bigfootism going on in the chat room tonight. Bigfoot is creepy. Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III, my favorite chatter, spits on Bigfoot. That's great. Unbelievable. Bigfoot has feelings too, kids. Bigfoot has feelings too. I'm actually ashamed of all of you. I'm ashamed of all of you. And it's what you're, what's going on with you? It's on American, kids. It's simply un-American. Dateline, the New York Post. And I don't know if this story is true. Llama's taste of chicken. I don't know if this story is true or not, but it must be a slow news day. Dateline, July 25, 1:54 p.m. Eastern Time. By author Emily Lefroy. Title, I only shower every 10 days. And I don't care if you think I stink. Showering is something most partake in daily, but one woman is claiming she regularly goes over a week without bathing, and she has never felt better. Link in the room, kids. Link in the room. Aiden Jane, 23, has both intrigued and disgusted people after posting a TikTok revealing she showers once every 10 days. Well, that's just pretty stupid. Why would you only do that? Why would you? Hang on. Oh, hang on a minute. Can we listen to this? I don't have a TikTok account, but can we listen to this crazy lady talk? Here, what is she saying?
Haven't showered in 10 days.
Oh, here we go.
I am living proof that you don't have to bathe often to look and feel good. Haven't showered in 10 days.
Well, I bet your vagina stinks. Apparently, it's been viewed 2.9 million times. Aiden, who calls herself, quote, the girl who doesn't shower and shows her period online, that's disgusting, claimed the only noticeable difference is her hair would be curlier if she washed her hair more regularly. Well, here's the deal. I think showering every day using heavy cosmetics is a bad thing. I don't even think she I'm guessing she doesn't even sponge bath. That's my guess. My guess is she doesn't shower or even go in a bathroom and do anything. She also responded to people's queries for the odor situation, saying she doesn't smell, despite skeptics urging her to shower more. Quote, I would argue it's better for the environment if we shower less because water is a precious resource. The TikToker said her shower schedule doesn't change when she has her menstrual cycle either. Quote, your period does not make you dirty. Periods are not dirty, she said, responding to a comment. Also, important to note that the vagina is self-cleaning, so you don't have to clean it because it cleans itself, she says. However, most comments were not on board with her once every 10-day bathing schedule. It's summer, one confused user commented, while others just said, nope. The lack of regular showering was embraced by Hollywood last year when celebrities like Jake Gyllenhaal, Matthew McConaughey, and Cameron Diaz admitted not showering daily. But here's the deal. Those folks probably have access, you know, to pools, and my guess is they're jumping in their chlorine-filled pool and then getting out and just rinsing off with water. I highly doubt these folks are going numerous days without showering. Although Dr. Julie Russick, a private practice dermatologist in Manhattan, previously told the Post, there's no harm in leaving a day or two between showers, she said. Not showering actually can harm your skin. Quote, you also have to still think about all the bacteria and toxins that accumulate on the skin, Russick said. When the body sweats, it's all a natural way of removing toxins. Still, you don't want to leave that sitting on top of your skin too long, encouraging pimples and other skin infections. Russick also said exercising regularly should follow with a quick rinse, although only in the areas that have higher concentrations of sweat accumulation. When you smell, it's time to take a shower, she said, adding that the bacteria that causes body odor also occurs alongside the same ones that can cause infections. So, shower lady. Look, what you should, you know, they even tell you this, right, in boot camp, right? If you're in country, you just have to sponge bath the primary areas. So, pits, mouth, meaning brush your teeth, front and back. You can figure out what the front and back means. Missing some comments in the room here. Yes, I think you should. People, when my grandparents had a cabin in northern Minnesota, and we would just go jump in the lake with a bar of soap. I mean, no suds would occur because of such hard water. But so I guess technically, we would not bathe. Traditionally, shower for probably the whole summer, but we swam every day. So there you go. There you go. What are you meowing for, cat? Sister Charles, what are you meowing for? Why are you meowing? I'm sorry, buddy. This cat has his own personality. I'm sorry, did you bump your head? He will meow and then turn his back to me as if to say, go pound sand, Mario. Go pound sand. Here's an interesting story that you may have came across online, but just so you know, it's fake. Was a Texas man arrested for dressing as an alien and abducting people? The claim was that a 73-year-old man arrested for kidnapping and sexually assaulting several people after dressing up as an extraterrestrial. This was not true. One of the more insidious factors in the spread of online disinformation has been the advent of satirical blogs that spread and republish each other's content, among them World News Daily Report. As BuzzFeed reported, the blog was responsible for 9 of the 50 most read faked stories of 2018, including 2 of the top 3. In that light, a WNDR post about 73-year-old Arnold White recycles the site's formula, an outlandish accusation alongside a misappropriated mugshot of a real person. In this case, WNDR states that White confessed to kidnapping and sexually assaulting several dozen people while using costumes, drugs, and special effects to have his victims believe they had been abducted by aliens, end quote. Originally interrogated about 4 crimes committed in the region in the 1990s, the retired trucker confessed to a total of 79 kidnappings across California, Nevada, New Mexico, and Texas over the period of 40 years. Mr. White confessed to using a mix of hallucinatory drugs containing LSD and PCP to subdue his victims before approaching them and carrying them inside his truck to assault them. As is customary, the post was spread verbatim on other spurious blogs without the inclusion of WNDR's disclaimer. Quote, World News Daily Report assumes all responsibility for the satirical nature of its articles and for the fictional nature of their content. All characters appearing in this article in this website, even those based on real people, are entirely fictional, and any resemblance between them and any person living or living dead or undead is purely a miracle. Regardless of its intention, the story spread to the point that an El Paso radio station, Kiss FM, published its own post on its website reminding readers that it was fake. Quote, now El Paso isn't perfect, and we have our weirdos, but this weirdo doesn't belong to us, the station wrote. So if you came across the story about an El Paso man by the name of Arnold White, who apparently dressed up as an alien and sexually abused people, is and was 100% inaccurate. Breaking news from a Blessing in the chat room. Looks like we've got, I can't read that one because it's behind a paywall. I don't like paywalls. 2 people killed in a shooting at a Los Angeles park, police say. Occurred around 3:50 p.m. at Peck Park in L.A.'s San Pedro neighborhood. The LAPD tweeted it wasn't an active shooter situation, but provided no more information. L.A. Fire Department said the incident occurred at or near a car show, that at least three people suffered gunshot wounds and two of them were in critical condition. Seven people overall, four men and three women, were injured and taken to hospitals, according to the fire department. And that is all we know. It'll be interesting to find out who the suspect is, who the suspect may or may not be. First launched in 1826, the HMS Daedalus, was a 46-gun ship of the top-line frigate of the Royal Navy, having never been used in combat in that capacity. After 18 years of service in 1844, the HMS Daedalus was literally cut down in size and recommissioned as a smaller, faster, more maneuverable 19-gun corvette of the Royal Navy. On August 6, 1848, the HMS Daedalus was cruising in the South Atlantic about 300 miles off the coast of West Africa. The weather was dark and cloudy and seemed to presage the onset of a midsummer thunderstorm at sea. At approximately 5 o'clock in the afternoon, midshipmen aboard the Daedalus alerted their officers to a most unusual sight. The ship's captain, Peter McCahey, along with First Lieutenant and all the ship's officers, rushed to the quarterdeck to view what the crewmen had described as, quote, a sea serpent, swimming above the surface of the water alongside their ship. Captain M. McKeehee, an experienced mariner, to say the least, was nearly two decades of service in the Royal Navy under his belt, stated in his official report, and I quote, our attention being called to the object, it was discovered by to be an enormous serpent with head and shoulders kept about 4 feet, constantly above the surface of the sea. Another ship's officer who viewed the supposed sea serpent that afternoon but chose to remain anonymous in a report he gave to the London Illustrated News sometime in October of 1848, just after the Daedalus returned to port, stated that, quote, the animal was moving at probably not more than 10 miles per hour, the water swaying under its chest. It was not more than 200 yards away from the ship. The eye, the nostril, the color and form were all distinctly visible. To this day, the sighting of the giant unknown serpent-like creature in the waters of the South Atlantic by the crew remains one of the most well-documented and controversial sea monster sightings in history. From the very moment the Daedalus returned from its voyage to its home port in Plymouth, England, controversy and debate have swirled around what was or what was not witnessed by the crew on that stormy day at sea in August of 1848. With the testimony of literally hundreds of sailors and dozens of Royal Navy officers to draw upon, the story of the so-called Daedalus Sea Serpent immediately became a mid-19th century Victorian era media sensation. The first report of the sea serpent sighting, the after-action report of none other than the captain, was published in the London Times on October 10, 1848, less than a full week after the HMS Daedalus had returned to port, writing with both the detailed detachment that was demanded of a 19th century Royal Navy officer, but also with some of the emotion and wonder of a person who had just had a close encounter with the unexplained, the captain echoing the anonymous statement of his fellow officer in the London Illustrated News remarked that, quote, it passed rapidly, but so close under our lee quarter that should it had been a man of my acquaintance, I should have easily recognized his features with the naked eye, end quote. What makes the Daedalus Sea Serpent sighting so remarkable is that so many officers and men of the ship were willing to stake their careers, reputations, and even questions of their own sanity by publicly stating to members of the Victorian print media descriptions of what they had seen. For that reason, even the nearly two centuries later, the sightings by the crew still remains one of the best pieces of evidence that we have for the existence of sea serpents or unexplained cryptids of the sea. The fact that the sea serpent was sighted by crew members, including a substantial number of officers of the Royal Navy, gave reports of the sea monster instant credibility in British newspapers of the time. Royal Navy officers were expected to be gentlemen, men who were cool under pressure and under fire, both literally and figuratively. By the middle of the 1800s, naval officers were, by and large, educated men, with at the very least a working knowledge of mathematics, meteorology, navigation, marine biology, and any number of other natural sciences. Men like Captain Peter Mulcahy were not normally given to telling yarns or tall tales of the sea. Newspaper readers across Great Britain greeted reports of what the press dubbed the HMS Dedalus Sea Serpent with wonder and astonishment. But this isn't to say that the tale of the unknown sea monster wasn't without its detractors. Dedalus. Or is it Daedalus? Is it a long E or a short E? Is it Dedalus or Daedalus? Or Dedalus? Phonetically read it out for me, Pat. Sir Richard Owen was an English biologist who lived from 1804 to 1892 and was known for his pioneering work studying ancient Daedalus. Thank you. For his pioneering work studying ancient fossils, he is best remembered for coining the term dinosauria, singular form for dinosaur, meaning terrible or great reptile, in the 1840s, and for his criticism of Charles Darwin's On Origin of Species and the theory of evolution that it propounded in the 1860s. Though Owen himself admitted that some form of evolution probably did occur within species, he believed that Charles Darwin's take on the whole matter was far too simplistic and contained some glaring omissions. Anyway, the purpose here is not to get bogged down in an age-old evolutionary debate, but rather to establish Robert Owen's credentials as one of the most respected scientific minds in all of England during the mid-19th century. In the autumn of 1848, in the wake of the HMS Daedalus Sea Serpent reports, Sir Richard Owen was on the faculty at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland and literally rewriting our understanding of prehistory with his research into dinosaurs. Only a week after he chose to break the story of the Daedalus sea serpent by publishing a transcript of Captain Mulcahy's official report, oddly enough, perhaps only simple stir-up to debate among the general public and sell more newspapers, the London Times published an interview with biologist Sir Richard Owen in which he stated that what the crew most likely saw was, quote, nothing more than a large swimming elephant seal, end quote. Owen went on to further suggest that what the crew of the Daedalus had interpreted as the serpent's nearly 60-foot-long tail was simply, quote, the wake left behind in the water by the swimming elephant seal, end quote. When the captain heard of what the Times had published in direct contradiction to his official report, and when he read the famed biologist Sir Richard Owen had accused his crew of not being able to identify the body of a, quote, giant swimming elephant seal, end quote, from that of an unknown sea serpent, as you can imagine, he was furious. And he fired back at his critics and detractors in the press immediately. Unfortunately, within weeks of his after action, Daedalus report, all of this talk of sea serpents and sea monsters in the British press was causing the Royal Navy no end of embarrassment. Things got so bad that Parliament launched an official investigation into the sanity of top-ranking naval officers and ships' captains within the Royal Navy. Parliament questioned how any self-respecting, let alone sane officer of the Royal Navy could have allowed a report in which he claimed to have sighted a sea monster be willfully published in Great Britain's most widely read newspaper. As it turned out, neither captain of the HMS Daedalus nor the Royal Navy had the answer, but rather than back down from their critics and detractors, along with other members of the crew, they took the offense. The members worked in conjunction with an artist commissioned by the Illustrated London News, perhaps the London Times' chief competitor, and produced a series of remarkable sketches and engravings of the HMS Daedalus Sea Serpent for all the world to see. As you can imagine, the Royal Navy was aghast. But the public ate up the pictures they saw in the Illustrated London News, and the images were reproduced literally en masse around the world. It should also be remembered that in his attempt to explain away the sighting by the crew of the HMS Daedalus, respected biologist Sir Richard Owen never once even bothered to consider the possibility that the crew saw that day could have been some sort of species of sea serpent or some type of cryptid still unknown to science of the time. At a time before published photography, these professional images of the Daedalus sea serpent, which were painstakingly based on eyewitness accounts of the 6th of August of 1848, firmly cemented the sighting of the HMS Daedalus sea serpent as one of the most remarkable, and at least to the Victorian reading public, one of the most believable encounters with a purported cryptid sea creature to ever take place in history. Though even today, there are those who attempt to discredit and explain away what the crew of the HMS Daedalus saw on the afternoon of August 6th, 1848, including most recently a study published by the Skeptical Inquirer in 2015, which asserts that what the crew of the Daedalus witnessed that day was a rare species of whale swimming past their ship. There has never been a 100% satisfactory explanation to explain away the sighting as something other than an unknown monster of the sea. There you go, kiddies. I did not know Dinosaurus Thunder King. Speaking of cryptids,
these following stories have been taken from the subreddit, No Sleep. Story 1. I'm an animal control officer for a rural county. I cover an area that has isolated communities of people who don't trust outsiders. I say this because after this call, I couldn't get anyone to talk to me. In dealing with these communities, I have had some rather strange calls. One such call was made by a woman whose family had moved into one of these places. She and her husband were doctors, and since rural doctors are hard to come by, her and her husband wanted to fill that need. For the two of them, though, it was a bit of a culture shock. A problem that the doctors ran into was a number of animals that were allowed to run loose. This triggered several calls from the woman to me about aggressive dogs. There wasn't much I could do about the dogs because every time I showed up, the dogs had been hidden. The last call I received from her would also be one of the most terrifying calls. I was called once again about an aggressive animal, but this time she wasn't sure if it was a dog or not. She'd made a house call to a family that lived at the end of a long dirt road. When she got there, everything was normal as much as it could be under such circumstances. It was when she stepped into the house that things got weird. She told me that while she was doing a checkup on the children, she heard a growling noise coming from behind a wall. When she asked the family about it, they quickly escorted her out of the house. She called me when she got home because she thought it might have been a mountain lion or some other big cat. I was skeptical because our area is known for bears and no mountain lions have been spotted in years. I didn't tell her this, though, because she sounded upset enough. I told her I'd check it out regardless, and when she gave me the address, we said our goodbyes. I looked up the address and saw that it would take me at least 2 hours to get there. This house was located in one of the remotest parts of the county. I planned for a morning drive so that I would get there before it got too hot. We were heading into summer, and I'm a big man that doesn't handle heat very well. I hate having to hike through the forest when it's hot out, and because of where this place was located, I wouldn't be able to drive up to the house. Bright and early the next morning, I loaded up my truck and headed out. I stopped by the gas station for some coffee and gas. With that done, I headed out of town on my way to the middle of nowhere. It was a nice drive, and I got to the dirt road about 30 minutes early. Since it was still early, I stopped to stretch my legs and use the bathroom. I was surrounded by forest with the closest house over a mile away, so I wasn't worried about being caught with my pants down. With that need taken care of, I used some hand sanitizer and headed out again. The doctor had warned me that the road was poorly maintained, and I knew immediately that she hadn't been exaggerating. The first pothole I hit, I thought I was going to tear off my front tire. I slowed down further until I was going about 2 miles an hour. Even going at that speed, I felt like I was in a paint-shaking machine. By the time I got to the end of the road, my teeth were rattling. I gratefully stopped when I reached the end and sat for a minute waiting for my insides to settle back where they were supposed to be. Then I grabbed my gear and stepped out of my truck. I'd brought some water, a gun, and a tranquilizer. If there was a wild animal, I didn't know how I was going to catch it by myself. The hope was that it was another false call, and I didn't have to worry about it. Right now, though, my biggest concern was getting to the house without getting lost. I looked around, and like when I stopped for a break, all I could see was trees. Other than that, there was something that felt off about the forest surrounding me. I felt the hairs on the back of my neck standing up, and regardless of how warm it was, a shiver crawled its way down my back. I frowned at the feeling. In my line of work, listening to your instincts could save your life, and I almost got back into my truck and left. I took a deep breath and shook the feeling off. There was no reason for my panic, and I told myself I was being ridiculous. I made my way to the faint trail I could see between some trees. Once I was there, I set my GPS so that I could find my way back to the truck. With that taken care of, I started on my walk. The doctor had told me the house was a half a mile from the end of the dirt road. As I walked down the path, I became aware of the lack of sound. Usually, I would hear birds, bugs, or animals moving through the underbrush. Now, there was nothing to hear except my footsteps. I kept looking around me, hoping to spot any sign of life, but I was out of luck. All I could see was the sun shining down through the trees, and I could feel the temperature rising as the morning wore on. Then as I got closer to the house, I could hear the sound of children playing and animals calling out. I felt myself sag in relief at the sounds of life after such a quiet walk. The relief didn't last long, though, because as I pushed through the trees into a clearing, I saw that there was no one there. I froze and looked around. I could see paddocks and an old barn that looked like it was about to fall. Away off from that, I saw the house in question. It was dilapidated, much like the barn. It looked like a stiff breeze was all it needed to bring it down. By now, I was starting to wonder if I'd been sent on a wild goose chase. This looked nothing like what the doctor had described. I swallowed and forced my feet to move. "This is animal control. Is there anyone home?" I called out as I moved further into the clearing. The silence was my only answer. I moved closer to the paddock, and I jumped back with a small cry. Laying in the paddock was a freshly dead cow. But not just any cow. This one had 3 massive claw marks down its side. On top of that, its eyes were bulging out along with its tongue. The cow looked like it had been choked and clawed to pieces. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't think of anyone strong enough to choke out a cow. I left the paddock and turned back toward the house. I decided I would leave the barn because it looked too dangerous for me to go into. "Hello, is anyone there?" I called out again. I knew if I was smart, I would turn tail and run. I couldn't leave without making sure someone didn't need my help, though. With the damage to the cow, I was worried about what had happened to the family that lived here. If, in fact, anyone lived here at all. I reached the rotting front porch, and I stopped before climbing the stairs. The front door was hanging on by one hinge, and the windows were broken. It looked like no one had been here in many years. "Hello? This is Animal Control. Is anyone home?" I called out for the third time. Of course, I didn't get an answer, and I was about to call off the search. Before I could turn around, I heard a faint cry like that of a child. "Is someone there?" I hollered as I cautiously climbed the stairs. I heard the sound again, and it sounded like it was getting closer. I pulled out my flashlight and shone the light in through the open doorway. All I could see was debris from the forest and a thick layer of dust on the floor. I stepped closer to the door, and the porch let out an alarming creak. I froze, but the door held. By now, I was calling myself an idiot for not leaving already. The cry came again, so I forced myself to step through the door. Inside, it looked like the family had simply disappeared. Everything was still in its place. In the corner of the room, there was even a dinner sitting on the dining table. The air in the house smelled of decay and mold. As I walked deeper into the room, it was completely quiet in the house now. All that I could hear was my increasing heart rate and the air moving in and out of my lungs. This quiet didn't sound natural to me, and my uneasiness was growing. I decided that now would be a good time to pull out my gun. If something tried to grab me, I hoped I would be fast enough to defend myself. Watching where I stepped, I moved farther into the house, trying to find the source of the original noise. The house had only one story. The kitchen, dining room, and the living room took up one half of the house. I stopped outside of the kitchen door and glanced in to see if anything was waiting for me. The kitchen was like the rest of the house, with the remains of supper sitting on the stove. I didn't go into the room because there was a hole in the middle. Moving on, I found the first bedroom across from the kitchen. From the decorations in this room, it was a child's room. Not seeing anything of interest, I moved past the next kid's room to the largest bedroom at the end of the hall. I stepped into this room, and the first thing I saw was blood smeared across the wall behind the bed. It was in the shape of large claw marks, and I tensed at the second sign of violence. I looked around the room, and my eyes slid across a shadow. When it struck me that something was there, I brought the flashlight up, hoping that I was seeing things. No luck, because sitting in the corner was an animal I'd never seen before. It was as tall as me sitting down, and on each of its front feet were three massive claws. The muscles of the front legs looked strong enough to strangle a hippo, much less a cow. The creature gave a low cry, and I went cold. It sounded like a child crying. I started backing toward the door, and the creature stood up. I could see instantly I was right about its size. I watched in horror as it opened its mouth and started panting. It had rows of massive teeth, and even from where I was, the smell was horrible. Its back legs were as muscled as its front legs, and I wondered how I could outrun this thing if I had to do so. I took another step back, and the creature stepped forward. It felt like some kind of strange dance as I walked backward and the creature matched my steps. I brought my gun up and leveled it on the creature. It hadn't made any threatening move toward me beside playing follow the leader. I had a feeling, though, that it was waiting for me to let down my guard. At the sight of the gun, the creature lunged for me, and I quickly fired off two shots. The creature fell back with a deafening roar. I used this opportunity to turn and run, not taking time to find out where I hit the creature. I knew I had wounded it, so I was hoping it was enough for me to get away. As I ran toward the front door, I prayed to every god I can think of that the floors would hold. Somehow, I made it to the front door, and from behind me, I could hear the creature trying to get up. It was making these awful whimpering and crying noises. It sounded so much like a child in extreme pain that I almost turned back. I called myself an idiot and took off running again. That day I found my inner track star and I ran as hard as I could to the safety of the trees. I was hoping that I had enough of a head start. I was also hoping that the creature didn't have a good sense of smell, because when a man my size sweats, everyone within 100 feet can smell me. I found a place to hide, and I waited anxiously for the creature to find me. After 10 minutes, I grew tired of hiding. I clutched my gun in my right hand and cautiously stepped out of my hiding place. I looked around, but the coast was clear. I started toward my truck, expecting to be attacked at any moment. As I walked, I could have sworn that there was something behind me. Every time I checked, though, there was nothing there. I still jumped at every sound, and I was constantly checking behind me. Although it had been quiet when I first walked down this path, now it sounded like every branch in the forest was cracking. Somehow I made it to my truck unmolested. When I stopped to catch my breath near my truck, I saw to my horror that there were 3 long claw marks down the side of the driver's door. I quickly fumbled my keys out of my pocket, something I knew I should have done already, I know. I managed to get the door open without dropping the keys. Once the door was opened, I scrambled inside. I was desperate for some water, but before I could reach for my thermos, I saw movement. I looked up and saw the creature was watching me. I swallowed a scream at the sight. I felt the creature was playing with me. It started moving toward me, and I frantically turned the truck on. I jerked it into reverse and made the fastest turnaround I've ever done in my life. As I started forward, I saw the creature stop. This last thing I saw in my rearview mirror was an elderly man with 2 bullet holes in his chest. I almost ran into a tree at the sight, but I wasn't stopping to ask questions. I made it back home in record time. I ran into my house and placed a call to the doctor that had sent me out to that house. I desperately wanted answers, and she was the only one to have them. Instead of the woman doctor, a confused elderly woman answered the phone. I asked for the doctor, and the elderly woman told me that she'd lived in her house for 50 years. She also told me that the phone number I called had been hers for the past 20 years. I apologized for bothering her and hung up the phone. I was now confused and terrified. I made some more calls, but everyone I talked to said they didn't know who I was talking about. I don't know who I had been talking to, but it wasn't a doctor wanting to help some unfortunate people. I never went back to that house. Some instinct was telling me that was why the creature had let me go. It wanted me to bring more people to investigate. Therefore, that would be more food for him. I had no intention of doing that. For one, who would believe me? And 2, I may be a bit stubborn, but I'm not stupid. I had gotten away once, but I doubt I would get away again. I've since left that job, and all I've been able to figure out was that creature could be related to a Wendigo. I'm probably wrong, though, because the only similarity I could find between the two was the eating of people. So that's the story of my most terrifying call, and the reason I left a fairly easy job. For me, no job is worth getting eaten by some mystical creature. Story 2. No names or locations will be mentioned for protection and safety reasons. My name isn't really important, but what I say here may be very important. And all you need to know is that I am a resident of a rural community in an, as of late, isolated county. I've had my suspicions, and I've been observing and documenting the happenings of my town from my cabin. These are my findings. Let me lay some cards on the table with a stupid question. Is anyone here familiar with the Sasquatch? Whether you believe or not, numerous people all over the world have claimed to have seen these creatures, or similar creatures, big, hairy humanoids living out in the woods and or mountains. Just about every continent has its own variation or myth of these things. I became a researcher, or at least reading up on others' research, on account of the increase of sightings in my county or region. It started about a month ago when our local rangers noticed a significant decrease in the deer and elk population and an increase of their half-eaten bodies cluttering the region. Naturally, we assumed it was bears, but if you're reading this now, you can probably guess that it wasn't the case. Rangers and hunting parties started to plan a culling or hunt to deal with what we thought was at least one super aggressive bear. Normally, they wouldn't let mere hunters on the reserve, but in this case, several farmers found these carcasses on their fields. One was found in a barnyard. In retrospect, we should have noted that among the animal carcasses found, all of them had their faces eaten. We didn't think much of it. The local suspicions of a bear was seemingly confirmed when the 4-year-old son of one of the local farmers spotted what he called the bear man climbing over a fence in his family's field. The man part we naturally dismissed, writing it off as the over-imaginative exaggerations of a child. As part of the hunting expedition, many have set up trail cams along the borders of the forest and fields, hoping to pinpoint the animal. Or should we say, animals. There were different sightings taking place as different locations at or around the same time. And despite our first glances, these animals were not bears. They had the face, hair and build you expect to see on a bear, but their actual body was humanoid in shape when they stood upright. You can tell when it's a bear walking on its hind legs, and what the camera caught was a clear, human-like structure. As you can imagine, there was a bit of a spectacle when these trail cam images were leaked to the town. At first, rangers only let the farmers and hunters know, but one of the farmers wanted some attention, so they tried to leak it to the media. Pretty soon, the town was up in arms about it. Some citizens were ecstatic, others afraid. Others skeptical that Bigfoot has made this region his home. Some wanted the hunting to cease, maybe capitalize on the Sasquatch sightings that had been pouring in. The less enthusiastic and more rational insisted that the hunting continue, rationalizing that these were in fact bears and that camera tricks and perception issues were involved. Others thought the whistleblower must have photoshopped the images to play attention hog, and rangers insisted that these were mere bears and it was voted up that they needed to be culled or driven away for the townspeople's safety. Before the following, there hasn't been any confirmed aggressive behavior from these things. One weekend, a family made their stay at their vacation home, a cabin, from their usual lives in the city. They came by every year during the summer, certain holidays and other special occasions to revisit their family living in the area. Not one day into their vacation, the mother took her 2 young children for a walk on a trail. She was warned to stay on the trail so as to avoid hunters. It wasn't long before her little girl pointed to get her mother to look at the monkey people that had been following them. That's 2, and the mother insisted they keep their distance from this wild family. The little girl began yelling and waving at the animals who were staring at them from several dozen yards away. Eventually, one started advancing towards them, huffing and puffing and growling at them, and the mother hastily took her children back to the cabin. They left the next day, which is a good thing, because the day after they left, their cabin was ransacked. Once again, blamed on by the bears. Unfortunately, that was the more passive of incidents. You'd probably roll your eyes when you hear the story of a kid waking up his parents in the middle of the night, crying about some kind of man with no face in the trees outside his window. I rolled my eyes too before I read the rest of the report. But what the report says is no laughing matter. There was in fact a man's dead body hanging in the trees in front of the child's window, and said face was chewed off. The body was identified as a local shopkeeper whose family lived just out of the outskirts of town. He wasn't labelled missing, but his sister, whom he lived with, mentioned how he hadn't come home the night before, and she wanted to wait until morning before she pestered the police about it. Her brother's car was found shortly after, pulled off the side of a road in a forest area on a highway, not a quarter mile away from their home. It was here we decided that this animal, or animals as it were in fact a danger to humans. They had to be hunted, and they had to be killed. But that was easier said than done. You can count how many times someone tried to hunt what they've said was Bigfoot. How many have been a success? These things have evaded hunters for centuries, and it's not like it was going to stop that night. What they did find was what they thought was an oddly placed beaver dam, placed in the deepest parts of the woods where hikers, rangers and hunters alike generally don't go. There was a pungent smell in the air, and when they investigated the oddity of mud and logs, there were at least 17 bodies, human and animal alike. All of them were half eaten, but the constant being that the beast that had been eating them had had a special affinity for their faces. Only 4 bodies have been identified, missing persons from 7 months back. The rest couldn't be accounted for, but there have been a series of missing persons in the outer forests that extend well beyond the county's borders. None of these creatures have been found. But we did find a series of large human-like footprints leading away from the territory and towards the town. That, and dozens more of these dams, and upon further investigation we could infer that these were not homes to these creatures, but but more or less fridges to store their meals. Now comes the part where I give you a little folklore lesson. My research. As you may or may not know, with all these Sasquatch sightings recorded, some descriptions may vary. For the most part, people claim to see what they would call a standard Bigfoot, just a big, humanoid, man-like ape. But there are others that Sasquatch researchers categorize as types. Once in a while, people claim to see what they describe as looking more bear-like than man. The common name among Sasquatch enthusiasts of this type is the Gagu, a name that derives from the name Kakus. It is often described in comparison to the Wendigo, which should give you an idea of what kind of animal we are dealing with. First Nations told legends of these with a description of man-eating ogre-like creatures. Not exactly the cute or cuddly-friendly Bigfoot you see in cartoons or media, right? Well, as a matter of fact, these things are described as being separated from what most people would call Sasquatch. They are closer to being bear-like than ape-like. Among the names the natives have for them was the Face Eater, and of course, due to their appearance and facial structure, the Bear Man. When people describe the Sasquatch, specifically their heads and faces, you get something closer to a human, gorilla, or chimp-like face. The Gagu has a snout, according to witnesses, to be more akin to baboon or mandrill. Some sightings have mistaken them for werewolves or dogmen. Besides appearances, these beings were different from what was considered a normal Bigfoot. When they describe Sasquatches, they describe creatures that are rarely hostile, mostly docile, omnivores that generally keep to themselves from humans. Albeit, they are still territorial. These things were famous for affinity of eating flesh, violent temperament, and will actively hunt humans. Unlike the Sasquatch, sightings of these things have increased in recent years, with most people passing them off as one and the same. In the farther north of the America-Canadian-Alaskan regions, there are legends there too. There, they are referred to as the Genosuke, and again, often overlapped with the myth of the Wendigo. They describe how these things are nocturnal, how they'd live underground, how they were not only cunning hunters, but efficient survivors. They got the nickname the Stone Giants by adorning their fur with mud and rocks, forming makeshift armor on them. My further research from a number of sources tells me that while they are more often than not solitary hunters, they do operate as family groups and rarely, if ever, hunt together. How they function is hardly any more pleasant than what is previously described. Some of my sources tell of how these creatures practice cannibalism to their dead when they are unsuccessful in their hunting, how in colder weather they wear the hide of their kills, and some even describe how they have a tribe-like mentality. This begs the question of just how intelligent they really are. One could almost call them evil, insofar as you can call a species of animal evil. Conclusions and concerns. Which brings us to here. As with the rise of Sasquatch sightings around the world, there has also been a rise of sightings of the Gagu or Genosuke, and I have more than enough reason to believe that we are getting a special rise of these creatures in my hometown. 4 days ago, schools were closed because large dark shapes could be seen walking or standing near the forested areas just off the school grounds, separated only by a small field and a chain-linked fence. When the kids left the schools, there were 4 of them walking, standing by, watching the elementary school, and had been specifically observing the buses before disappearing back into the trees. One of the local farming families left town in a hurry last weekend when a dog ran into a barn to confront an intruder. The dog never came out, and when the farmer investigated, he almost immediately ran out, got his family into the car, and fled the property without so much as a word to the confused neighbors. Days later, said neighbors noticed a thick, pungent smell, muskier than anything that usually comes out of a barn. It was as if it was stuffed with dead and decaying bodies. The dog's remains were later found just off one of the neighbor's property, when the animals on his own farm started acting up on a disturbance. All that remained of the dog was a spine, ribs, and mandible.
Apparently, Bigfoot also eats dogs and sexually assaults women, as you heard a few weeks ago. Next hour, we will hear the most epic Yeti attack in the history of Yeti attacks. I mean, it's 8 minutes of gloriness, folks. You're tuned into This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution.radio at freedomslips.com. Common spelling in your favorite internet browser. Remember, we're 100% listener supported. Head over to the website, click on the chevron, top left corner, right corner, I'm sorry. It'll drop down the nav bar if you have your window minimized. If not, nav bar's across the top of your screen. Click on donations. You can become a Patreon donor box. We accept direct payment from North America only. We have some cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is down. It's down, son. I can write a check. It'll make its way to Allen, Michigan. Never been there, but I heard it's nice. If you want to know everything about Bitcoin, you just talk to the right Reverend Dr. Mr. Rowe, and he will set you straight. Go back into what one? No, we're not. We won't go back into the sexually assaulting Bigfoot because that was inappropriate, and I've got some low standards for inappropriateness. Here comes the top of the hour music, folks. Again, next hour, the most epic Yeti Bigfoot attack in the history of Bigfoot attacks. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Who owns you? If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire.
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, welcome back, Buck. Soon we're going to get to the most epic Yeti Bigfoot attack in the history of Bigfoot attacks, and I don't know how that's going to go, but you know, it is going to be what it is. But first, staircases in the woods. Are there really staircases to nowhere? Between the absurd, all but sometimes creepy monoliths that appear and disappear worldwide in abandoned stairways to heaven, the world is a scary place. Anyone who has ever seen one of the bizarre hidden treasures known, it is one of a kind experience. Many questions whether they exist at all or just a Reddit hoax by a terrific storyteller. Here are all of your questions answered about staircases in the woods. So what exactly are they? The stairs are an internet phenomenon that grew from the discovery of these weird structures. The stairs spawned an entire story from Search and Rescue Woods on Reddit, and later an entire season of Channel Zero. Like the best viral stories, it branches off into different directions from different people. A national park rescuer started the story and spoke of a Wendigo-like creature near the stairs. From there, the story catches like wildfire. And stairs haunt eerie towns, Boy Scout troops go missing, and wandering babies stalk the night. It is nightmare full fuel for sure. If you don't want to sleep and have hours to kill, it is an ideal rabbit hole to fall down. All the stories of mysterious sounds, pristine carpets, bright lights, and dead vegetation that some report are likely not true, the stairs' ominous presence are enough to lend at least a little credence. I wouldn't camp next to one just to be on the safe side. Do the staircases in the woods actually exist? Surprisingly, they are very real. The mysterious stairways have appeared in at least 7 countries, including the U.S. and Belgium, where the country's highest peak features of a stairway case in the sky. They can be made of stone, brick, iron, or wood, and are in all different decomposition states. Some are intricate, and others modest, spiral or straightforward. They come in all shapes and sizes. The most famous have all been named. Some of the scarier names are the Staircase of Missing Time on the Philippines and the Vanishing Staircase in the U.S. Most of them are found in national parks. Typically, they rise from the ground to the sky with very little additional structure attached, as if they are an anomaly drop from another dimension. The majority have very normal explanations for their existence. Someone at some point had built a structure and abandoned it. Staircases are typically the most robust part of any design, so they are the last to be reclaimed by nature. Their various stages of despair can be troubling, but rest assured, it's perfectly normal. The authenticity of the stories is questionable. The Reddit story is a work of fiction, but that doesn't mean there aren't real accounts that are out there in the world. As far back as the 1940s, there were stories of stairs that appeared or disappeared or moved all over Roswell, New Mexico. The aliens must be doing it. A doctor working in the area for the government reported stairs moving and leaving burn marks underneath. I'm certain they did. In the Philippines, a forest ranger was fired for being absent from the job. He climbed some stairs to avoid a dangerous dog and thought he was gone only a few minutes. In reality, it was days. I think he was drinking a little bit of the nectar. There have been claims that the derelict stairs are used for devil worship. Oh, you do say. Whether you believe the stairs are placed there by an entity from another place or time, or you think they are a fascinating artifact from a bygone era, no one can dispute they are intriguing. What may have worked, started as a great campfire story, turned into a free-flowing conversation from users claiming to have seen the stairs. Most claim to be scared silly. Very few images exist of the horrifying stairs, so there isn't much proof that they exist. Tracy Palmer, the author, is not willing to take any chances, though. And she urges that next time you are in the woods, watch your step. And just be on the safe side. Don't climb any stairs or ladder rungs. You never know where they might take you or how long you may be gone. Link to the story in the room from the Signal Horizon, author again, Tracy Palmer, for your reading enjoyment. Just so you know, Stairs in the Woods, the Reddit subreddit channel it appeared on first was called No Sleep. Hence, you know, you can't sleep or you don't want to go to sleep, read these scary stories. It's a common trope in stories about exploring deep in the woods is, you know, mysterious stairs leading to nowhere with no noticeable signs of the structure, right? They're usually found in context of searching for a missing person 10 or 30 or 50 or 100 miles into the forest by a professional rescue team, which is why, you know, David Plais talks about stairs just popping up, or so-and-so said they saw some stairs. When approached, the narrators relate either an overwhelming sense of dread or see glimpses of strange creatures nearby. Now, supposedly, park rescue teams consider this strange phenomena a common occurrence and have been instructed by their superiors to never approach, take photos, or talk about their existence, which is why we never have any photos. And if we do, they're of obvious stairs that were part of a structure that has now been reduced to earth. The veracity of these claims should be taken with a big grain of salt, as the subreddit No Sleep is a form intended for fictional creepypastas, presented as truth with an implicit suspension of disbelief to better engage with the story. However, since their appearance on the subreddit No Sleep, stories have popped up in other places as well, seemingly dropping the facade of telling a ghost story to relate real, strange experiences. And creepypasta is a term that refers to any short horror story existing on the internet, particularly when posting as a green text story. And they're fake, kiddies. They're fake. So if you come across some stairs in the woods, please take a photo and know that, you know, well, who knows what you'll know? You may know a lot of stuff, or you may know nothing. All right, folks. This may be, in fact, the most epic Yeti attack known to mankind ever recorded.
Today, our story takes us all the way back to April 1941, to Gulag Camp 303, around 400 miles from the Arctic Circle. One of these prisoners of Gulag 303 was Slawomir Rowicz, a Polish army lieutenant who was imprisoned by the NKVD after the German-Soviet invasion of Poland. Slawomir's duties at the camp included construction of the prisoners' barracks, the manufacture of skis for the Soviet Army, and the repair and operation of camp commandant's radio. The conditions were dire and saw enormous loss of life. After over 2 years of forced labor, Slawomir and five others planned their escape. And during a snowstorm, the sixth escaped the gulag and set out on one of the most epic journeys ever documented. They set out to walk to India, to freedom, a 4,000 mile journey. It was either try or die in a Russian gulag. They walked through Siberia, Mongolia, and the Gobi Desert, through Lhasa and Nepal, and eventually arriving in India. It was in between Lhasa and Nepal, however, where they saw something that would stay with them for the rest of their lives. After months and months of trekking through the snow and mountains, the group were exhausted, and then, they saw two creatures which they couldn't explain. The following is extracts from Slavomir's diary. Bearing in mind the year this was written, and that Slavomir's first language is Polish. The language is a bit strange, but the message he wanted to tell us is clear. In all our wandering through the Himalayan region, we have encountered no other creatures than man, dogs, and sheep. It was with quickening interest, therefore, that in the early stages of our descent of this last mountain, Kolomenos drew our attention to two moving black specks against the snow about a quarter of a mile away below us. We thought of animals and immediately of food, but as we set off down to investigate, we had no great hopes that they would wait our arrival. The contours of the mountain temporarily hid them from view as we approached nearer, but when we halted on the edge, we found they were still there, 12 feet or so below us and about 100 yards away. 2 points struck me immediately. They were enormous, and they walked on their hind legs. The picture is clear in my mind, fixed there indeniably by a solid 2 hours of observation. We just could not believe what we saw at first, so we stayed to watch. Somebody talked about dropping down to their level to get a close-up view. Zaro said they looked strong enough to eat us. We stayed where we were. We weren't too sure of these unknown creatures, which refused to run away at the approach of us. I set myself to estimating their height on the basis of my military training for artillery observation. They could not have been much less than 8 feet tall. One was a few inches taller than the other, in relation of the average man to the average woman. They were shuffling around quickly, round a flattish shelf, which formed part of the obvious route for us to continue our descent. We thought that if we waited long enough, they would go away and clear the way for us. It was obvious they had seen us, and it was equally apparent they had no fear of us. The American said that eventually he was sure we would see them drop on all fours like bears, but they never did. Their faces I could not see in detail, but the heads were squarish, and their ears must lie close to the skull because there was no projection from the silhouette against the snow. The shoulders sloped sharply down to a powerful chest. The arms were long, and the wrists reached the level of the knees. The back of the head was a straight line from the crown into the shoulders. We decided unanimously that we were examining a creature of which we had no previous experience in the wild, in zoos, or in literature. It would have been easy to have seen them waddle off at a distance and dismiss them as either bears or big apes of the orangutan species. At close range, they defied description. There was something both of bear and ape about their general shape, but they could not be mistaken for either. The colour was a rusty kind of brown. They appeared to be covered by two distinct kinds of hair, the reddish hair which gave them their characteristic colour, forming a tight close fur against the body, including long loose straight hairs hanging downwards which had a slight greyish tinge as the light caught them. Dangling our feet over the edge of the rock, we kept them closely under observation for about an hour. They were doing nothing but moving around slowly together, occasionally stopping to look around them like people admiring a view, their heads turned up towards us now and again, but their interest in us seemed to be the slightest. Then Zaro stood up. "We can't wait all day for them to make up their minds to move. I am going to shift them." He went off into a pantomime of arm waving, red Indian war dancing, bawling and shrieking. The things did not even turn. Zaro scratched around and came up with half a dozen pieces of ice, around a quarter inch thick. One after another, he pitched them down towards the pair, but they skimmed erratically and lost direction. One rock kicked up a little powder of snow about 20 yards from them, but if they saw it, they gave no sign. Zaro sat down again, panting. We gave them another hour, but they seemed content to stay where they were. I got the uncomfortable feeling they were challenging us to continue our descent across their ground. "I think they are laughing at us," said Zaro. Mr. Smith then stood up. "It is obvious they are not afraid of us. I think we better had go while we are safe." We pushed off around the rock and directly away from them. I looked back and the pair were still standing still, arms swinging silently. What they were for years remained a mystery to me. They then walked away, and through sheer determination and a desire to be free and live, 4 of the 6 arrived in India. Upon arrival, Slavomir weighed 5 stone, or 70 pounds. And after a few months in hospital, the 4 would go their separate ways, and they never saw each other again. The reason why this is one of the most convincing stories of the Yeti is the fact that it's just a small section of the book he wrote. Why would someone facing death and exhaustion make up a story like this? His story was made into a book and even a movie in 2010 called The Way Back. However, the movie doesn't mention the Yeti sighting. When asked years later about what he saw, he said that he doesn't care what others think. He knew what they saw on that day. Slavomir, the escaper and crusader for freedom, born September the 1st, 1915, died on April the 5th, 2004.
Oh, well, that's too bad that he passed away. I it didn't seem very convincing to me, but, you know, what do I know? What do I know? Who or what are the grays reported by witnesses in close UFO encounters? Grays are probably the best known and most reported alien species in close encounters of the third and fourth type. In fact, it is they who are often mentioned as the perpetrators of the abduction of human beings for the purpose of experimentation. In addition, in the popular imagination, the word alien is often associated with these big-headed beings with gray skin, thin bodies, short stature, and huge almond-shaped eyes. What can be deduced about them from the ufological causticism? Zetas. The first theory comes from the first reported abduction in modern history, the case of Betty and Barney Hill that we've discussed on this program several times. Although it could be said that the description of those abducted by the alien ship would be a mix between classic gray and something more reptilian. According to Betty Hill and a star map she saw inside the craft, these aliens are from the Zeta Reticuli, a broad binary star system in the southern constellation located 39.5 light years or 12 parsecs from Earth. The southern constellation of Reticulum. Its stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2, are roughly analogous to our Sun and are far enough apart to maintain stable planetary orbits. Furthermore, the fact that this system is much older than ours could mean that if the Greys lived there, they would have much more time to develop as a technological civilization. Another notable feature is that Zeta 1 and 2 are the closest stars to each other and are part of the galaxy just 1/8 light years away. Now, what they don't tell you about the Betty Hill star map is she literally had 2 years to put this thing together. So it wasn't as if the day after the abduction, they came, she drew this map. It was 2 years after the fact. So for the Betty and Barney Hill fans out there, let's not get too excited about this. One of the most heard explanations in ufology about One of the most heard explanations in ufology about the appearance of grays is that they are not biological beings, at least not entirely. And there are several features reported by witnesses that curiously point in that direction. The first is that they are all essentially the same, as if they were mass-produced robots. Their cold, emotionless demeanor towards abduction victims as machines fulfilling scientific goals of abducting, experimenting, and returning the human specimen to their location where it was found only adds beans to the notion of robotic aliens. Another noteworthy fact in the same vein is that Greys appear to be in the lowest echelon of humanoids reported by abductees, who have often described them as minions, perhaps robots, or reptilian in appearance, and much higher. More controversial testimonies, such as that of Philip J. Corso, a U.S. Army officer who was said to have participated in the investigation of technology and experiment extraterrestrial beings recovered from Roswell, the famous Roswell incident in 1947, argue that we should really consider these beings as humanoid robots instead of life forms. Thank you, Philip Corso. Quote, robots designed specifically for long distance travel through space or time, Corso opined shortly before his death. Contemporary scientists such as Harvard astrophysicist Avi Loeb support the notion and up the ante, claiming that we are likely being visited and studied by artificial rather than biological intelligences, and that contact is likely to occur when the intelligences do. On Earth, they reach a certain point and can converse with their extraterrestrial counterparts. This is the most controversial and distorted hypothesis, but also, if it is true, the one that most affects us as a species. The Gray's appearance may indicate that we've become so dependent on technology and machines that our bodies have evolved to be smaller and our brains and eyes larger. Furthermore, according to witnesses, these beings often communicate, often telepathically, using known human language. Quote, we know we are here. We know that humans exist. We know that we have a long history of evolution on this planet. And we know that our technology will be more advanced in the future. I think the simplest explanation is that it's us, said Michael Masters, a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Technical University in Butte, who has written a book expounding this hypothesis. Masters believes that the motivation of these extra tapestrians, as he calls them, may be scientific and tourist. On the one hand, archaeologists, biologists, historians, anthropologists, and other scientists would return to empirically studying the past. And on the other hand, it would certainly be good business or curiosity for the wealthier inhabitants of the future to see how things were hundreds or thousands of years ago. The fact that UFO crews do not want to make open contact may be the answer to the basic and unthinkable rule. Study the past without scientifically altering it so as not to harmfully alter the reality of the point on the timeline from which they departed. One final note we should mention. One of the most chilling and traumatic aspects mentioned by those kidnapped by the Greys, one that could be related to a lesser or greater degree with some or all of the hypotheses raised along these lines, that one of the main goals of these beings is to establish, wait for it, a new human hybrid extraterrestrial species. This notion stems from the fact that many of the female abductees report having been artificially inseminated, only to be kidnapped again by the Greys to extract the fetus. Additionally, some of the male abductees report that sperm was abstracted from them, or they were forced to have, yes, sexy time with hybrid females, presumably as a result of insemination of human females with extraterrestrial DNA. My own research points to an abundant evidence suggesting that what we are witnessing is a program of integration into society by hybrid beings and not necessarily by these types of alien appearance. I feel deeply ashamed to say this because I know how crazy it sounds, but as an academic, I have to go where the evidence takes me, and I have to be honest, commented Dr. David Jacobs, a professor of history and leading proponent of this hypothesis. Again, the hypothesis that the aliens are here to establish the main goal, one of the main goals, to establish a new hybrid human extraterrestrial species. Another academic, Dr. Yong-Hai Chi, a professor at Oxford University School of Oriental Studies, goes further, suggesting a correlation between climate change and alien abductions. What? Not only are scientists and theologians concerned about the survival of humans on this planet, but so are non-human species, argued Dr. Chi, who also added that the time when UFO activity increased considerably in the middle of the last century coincides with the development and testing of nuclear weapons, something that would have attracted the attention of species that monitor the world. Da, da, da. Da, da, da. See, kids, I've been telling it for years. When the alien abduction comes, that's why. You're gonna see an alien, you're gonna do a double take and say to yourself, wait a minute. That alien hybrid looks just like me. And then you think back in time how you lost some time, and then perhaps you had a nightmare where a female alien got on top of you and abused you sexually, and because it's biology, things happened, and now you got a kid out there, and a female alien is coming down to demand child support. That's the one thing that I don't quite understand. Why? How are? If he got the hybrid alien baby, and the aliens come down and extract the fetus from the child, obviously this fetus, this baby is going to end up having some adult features, right? Lungs, from all due accounts, right? The grays don't breathe oxygen. They don't speak. So is this hybrid going to have vocal cords? Are the vocal cords going to be forcibly removed? Are they going to, what if they have human-type eyes? What if there's a recessive gene in there for big droopy ears? What about noses? I mean, what do these things look like? That's what I want to know. What do the alien human hybrid babies look like? I'm interested. I haven't seen a photo. I mean, let's get off the Punnett square here. I mean, is it going to be a blue-eyed grayed alien or brown-eyed or hazel? Big ears, small ears, almond-shaped eyes, no almond-shaped eyes. What about facial hair, right? Are the alien hybrids going to grow Fu Manchus when they get older? These are questions that I need answers to. And this is the problem, is these UFO folks that claim that, we got these hybrid babies out there. I want to know what the genetic makeup is going to be. What do these babies look like? Nobody is telling me. Now I want to get to the bottom of it, but not now. Let's visit our friends over at Bedtime Stories.
This week on Bedtime Stories, we will be returning to Soviet-era Russia in order to delve deeper into a story originally referenced during a previous episode, that of a Cold War incident which allegedly resulted in the loss of a number of Soviet soldiers, a mystery known in smaller circles simply as the Plane in the Forest. As the transport labored its way through the cloudy skies, the young lieutenant surveyed the features of the men seated around him in the cramped cabin of the aircraft. For all their training and varied experience from previous missions, here and there he could still detect faint traces of apprehension. Given the circumstances surrounding the orders they had been given that morning by the base commander, this was perhaps unsurprising. Several days prior, a reconnaissance flight passing the Puutarhana Plateau had reported sighting a lone plane, sitting on the ground in the middle of a wooded area. Upon their return to base, the flight's pilots had duly filed their report, which in due course had been matched to an internal bulletin relating to a missing military aircraft. The lieutenant and his team had been ordered to conduct a search of the area, which was situated not far from the slopes of Mount Carmen. The paratroopers knew that the vast distance which lay between the crash site and their airbase represented the extreme operating range of the helicopter transporting them. There was little room for error within the mission parameters they had been given. If anything was to go wrong, they could well end up as isolated as the very target they had been ordered to investigate. And if he was honest, their commanding officer was equally as troubled by the same questions which preyed on the minds of each member of the patrol. What was a military plane doing out in the middle of nowhere, far beyond the distance it should have been able to fly, having made an apparently impossible landing in the middle of a heavily wooded forest? And perhaps more importantly, what fate had befallen the men who had been inside it? In past episodes, we have examined various incidents in which ships and aircraft have vanished altogether in remote areas such as the Bermuda Triangle and the Great Lakes. These have included the unsolved disappearances of Flight 19, as well as the loss of the French minesweepers Inkerman and Seri Soles. In other installments, we have also explored instances in which planes and vessels have been discovered with their entire crews slain under somewhat inexplicable circumstances. The most famous example of this would be the discovery of the Orang Medan, a ship found floating in the middle of the Indian Ocean, with all souls aboard exhibiting signs which suggested they had been scared to death. Another such story was recounted during our Enemy Unknown episode, relating to the mysterious loss of an American B-52 and her crew at the height of the Vietnam War. On that occasion, a US Special Forces team was dispatched to a remote area of the conflict, following the discovery of the aircraft which had apparently been brought down there. When they arrived, they found the entire crew dead, having been dispatched in a brutal and unknown fashion. More perplexing was the fact that the gigantic plane was sitting perfectly upright in between the tightly packed trees of a forest, with no explanation as to how it came to rest there. There was no damage to its fuselage or landing gear, or any of the trees which were still standing around it. It was as though the huge plane had been vertically lowered to the ground by an unknown force. During our retelling of this mystery, we went on to draw parallels with a similar report alleged to have taken place in Russia during the Cold War, in which a transport plane had been located in mysterious circumstances. We had nothing much to go on with regards to the details, but in the aftermath of that episode, we were later contacted by a subscriber from Russia, who stated that they had heard about the incident in question when they were younger. They explained that it's a popular story amongst members of their armed forces, having been passed down between those who served in the Siberian region and their wider families. We have since received emails from another subscriber who now resides in the United States, but whose family was originally from Russia, confirming the details of the tale. It's a mystery which remains unanswered to this day, having played out in one of the most remote and inhospitable corners of the Soviet Union. The story goes that during the summer of 1961, a paratroop officer based at Valak Airfield was unexpectedly summoned to see the base commander. He was given orders to select a team of his men, who would then be flown out to a far-flung region of the Siberian landscape on a search and rescue mission. Whilst en route to the location, as he had briefed his squad, the young officer had been perplexed at how any aircraft could have ended up in such an isolated area, well away from established flight paths. Several hours later, he and his team had been deposited on open ground, adjacent to an area of dense woodland, their pilots informing them that this was as close to their destination as they could safely land. It would take a further hour of meandering between varying densities of sprawling pines and spruces before they would finally reach their objective. There had been no small degree of commotion as the lead paratrooper had nearly collided with the metal fuselage, which seemed to have materialized out of nowhere. As his men instinctively formed a perimeter around the small transport aircraft, the lieutenant was far from oblivious to the quizzical expressions they were now exhibiting. The plane before them was an Antonov A-2, a small prop-driven transport, which was capable of carrying up to 12 passengers. It was painted in military colours, and was sat upright on the forest floor, perfectly intact as though patiently waiting to commence the return journey back to its base. There were no signs of impact damage to its fixed landing gear or propeller, with the trees and ground around it perfectly undisturbed, seeming to negate the possibility of a crash landing. Motioning for one of the NCOs to join him, the lieutenant moved tentatively towards the plane, struggling to come to terms with what they had discovered. At both the front and rear of the Antonov, there were dense bushes and thick tree trunks, obstacles which precluded the possibility of it landing where it was now sitting, or of it being taxied into the forest. Ducking under the wings and trying the external door, the pair discovered that it was locked. With the help of two other men, it would take several minutes for them to successfully force entry. Cautiously filtering into the main cabin, they found there was nobody aboard, and no signs that anything untoward had taken place. In the cockpit, the controls were set as if the plane was still in flight, as opposed to preparing to land. It was also discovered that none of the plane's electrical systems were working. The safety harnesses for both pilots were still securely fastened, despite the fact that their seats were now empty, and there was a half-full cup of coffee perched in one corner of the cockpit. Lying at the base of most of the seats in the main cabin were weapons, packs, and webbing, identical in nature to the ones that he and his fellow paratroopers were wearing. Conscious that the longer they remained there, the more his men would be affected by the mysterious and haunting nature of their discovery, the officer had ordered that all logbooks and papers be recovered. He then took several photographs of both the interior and exterior of the plane, before ordering his men to form up and commence the long walk back to their transport. Upon their return to Valak Airfield, once his report had been handed in, the lieutenant was ordered not to discuss the mission with anyone else, and to ensure that his men were given the same orders. But given the nature of military culture, the story would inevitably find its way out into the wider Soviet forces, prompting difficult questions, for which there were no easy answers. It is rumored that during their return flight back to base, the paratroopers took the liberty of reading the papers they had recovered from the Antonov, prior to handing them in to their superiors. The copy of the flight manifest recovered from the cockpit revealed that the transport had set off from Vorkuta-Sovietsky Air Base several months prior, for a short run into a neighboring airfield. Upon reading this, the soldiers had become increasingly unnerved. The base in question was used for the deployment of tactical bombers, situated just outside the city of Vorkuta. And yet, the missing transport plane had been found over 12,000 kilometers from both its takeoff point and official destination. Not only was this well outside of its maximum operating range, meaning that it would not be able to survive any return journey due to a lack of fuel, but it was also situated nowhere near any other Soviet military facility. In simple terms, the plane should not have been able to get as far as it had, and would have stood no hope of being able to land anywhere safely. In addition to this, the document made no reference to the flight having contained any passengers, raising awkward questions as to why equipment and weaponry typical of a paratrooper detachment had been found aboard it. The manner in which the Antonov had been discovered also made little sense, resting perfectly intact on the ground, as if it had descended vertically from the sky above. There was no sign that there had been any disturbance or struggle aboard it, with safety belts engaged and equipment resting close to hand in readiness if it was required. It almost seemed to the rescue team as if some mysterious force had somehow removed the crew and passengers from the aircraft in mid-flight, before gently lowering it to the ground. In the decades that followed, members of the team would make a number of discreet inquiries into the matter, usually when they encountered other soldiers who had served at the Vorkuta airbase. But such discussions would only ever elicit two forms of reply: that the servicemen they were talking to had no knowledge of the matter, or they were politely informed that they were asking dangerous questions. As a result, only whispers of what transpired were heard outside of Russia. In the years since, the story has been disseminated to small Russian communities outside of the military, and a number of theories have been put forward as to what might have transpired. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the one seized upon by those who have chosen to discuss the matter in a public forum is that the crew were subject to an alien abduction. Supporters of this theory speculate that the Antonov was taken under extraterrestrial control, the plane's crew and passengers being removed mid-flight before it was then deposited in a far-off location by their abductors. It is argued that this is why the missing men had not had time to remove their safety harnesses, apparently disappearing from inside a locked and secure cabin. It also might explain how the incident had clearly occurred whilst the aircraft was in mid-flight, but was then safely lowered to the ground amidst a packed forest, sustaining no apparent damage. Reports of incidents in which vehicles and their crews appear to have suffered a rapid and inexplicable misfortune are to be found elsewhere across the globe. In 1917, the three-masted schooner Zabrina was discovered adrift off the coast of France. Her hull was still packed full of the valuable coal she had been tasked to deliver, but there wasn't a soul aboard. The galley table had been laid out ready for breakfast, and the ship's logbook and papers were lying open on the captain's desk. But of her 23-man crew, there was no sign. In October of 1955, a merchant vessel named the MV Joyita was found in the South Pacific, with all 25 of her crew and passengers missing, despite the ship's cork reinforcement rendering her unsinkable. Other commentators have shied away from the idea of extraterrestrial involvement, citing the secretive and unaccountable attitude of the Soviet military towards weapons development. They believe this incident may be yet another example of Soviet armed forces conducting illicit experiments, with little regard for the safety of the soldiers involved in such projects. There is strong evidence that outside of the official narrative regarding the Soviet space program, numerous cosmonauts were successfully launched into orbit, only to die during their mission, their bodies still drifting lifelessly through space. The secrecy surrounding the incidents which would take place at Dyatlov Pass have also been attributed to military experiments, as well as more disturbing stories such as the infamous Soviet sleep experiment. Despite the latter being widely cited as a creepypasta, it is not beyond all possibility that there is a kernel of truth to it. Is it possible that the Antonov may have been carrying a technology which resulted in the loss of its occupants, or that it was subject to some form of portal or projected field, which resulted in the disappearance of its crew? There is, of course, a far more rational explanation for what took place, and this is that the incident is merely the military equivalent of an urban legend. It may well be that a search and rescue team was indeed dispatched to Mount Carmen, and did locate a downed aircraft there, one which had no valid reason to be where it was found, with the crew no longer present. The AN-2 remains one of Russia's most mass-produced aircraft, largely due to the impressive technical capabilities it possessed for its time. It had no apparent stall speed, meaning that in some circumstances, the pilot may have been able to idle and glide much further than its operational range. It was also capable of taking off and landing over very short distances, meaning that a talented operator could well have crash-landed it in woods, resulting in minimal damage. Stranded in the middle of nowhere, and with little hope of rescue, it isn't unreasonable to imagine that the plane's occupants might have set off into the Siberian tundra, perhaps never to be seen again. Elements of the story, such as the plane being impossibly sandwiched between trees, the crew's safety harnesses being engaged, and the controls being rigged for flight rather than landing, may well have been embellishments added over the years in order to add more intrigue. With the passage of time, details of the more clandestine events during the Cold War continue to slowly filter into the public domain. It is hoped that one day, answers to questions such as the fate of the Izdal woman and the death of Commander Lionel Crabb may yet become clear. And along with them, the truth surrounding the loss of an Antonov transport plane amidst the wild and untamed Siberian landscape.
You know, all these mysterious UFO shenanigans going on in the woods, and again, I have yet to encounter one. Apparently, Fleece in the chat room's got a jacked up truth, jacked up tooth. I'm sorry. Hang on, we got some homeopathic meds here. What do we got here? What do we got going? Hang on. Let's see what's going on. Got some homeopathic meds here for toothaches or something, I guess. Oh my gosh, I can't even. Excuse me, I had a little burp. Excuse me. Excuse me all to hell, as my grandfather used to say. Excuse me all to hell. So what do we got here? We got, I'm waiting for the page to open. Okay. How to use colloidal silver for a tooth abscess. It's a home remedy for tooth abscesses. Colloidal silver can be used in several different ways to help with an abscessed tooth. You can buy colloidal silver online or at a health food store. Typical use, swishing. Put a tablespoon of colloidal silver, 10 to 20, what does PPM stand for? Parts per million? Into your mouth and gently swish it around for 5 minutes. Spit out the colloidal silver. Repeat this every 3 to 6 hours or more if needed for severe pain. Okay. Spraying. You can apply it directly to the area of pain. Do this every hour. Do this often every hourly until pain resolves. Saturating. You can pour some colloidal silver on the cotton ball and apply this to the tooth that is bothering you. Change the cotton ball every 2 hours. So there you go. Just saturate in a cotton ball and stick that between your tooth and your cheek and gum. No, doesn't matter, Blessing. He'll get the whole thing out. He just yanks it all out. He'll get it. You pull it out, and then you just take a little Dremel tool, and you stick it down and just Dremel out the roots. You'll be good. Don't worry about it. No reason to worry about it. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. There you go. Get some colloidal oil and just apple cider vinegar, I hear, is good for warts. I can't tell off the bottom of my foot if it's just a callus or the wart is so deep in there. And because I walk, it's on the pad of my foot, so if I walk, it just continually pushes it down and spreads it out. But when my feet, when I, you know, wash my feet, I don't see the little rings. I think it's just a callus. I don't know, but I had a wart there for a long time, and I was working on that bad mamma jamma for a while. You dig at it every single day. I don't know. I can't tell. I don't know. Maybe it's just a deep callus. You would take COVID over a toothache. CS is a natural antibiotic. What is CS? Oh, colloidal silver. Wait. Clorox soap? Clorox soap is a natural antibiotic? That's potential spam. Oh, should we see if there's a potential spam? Hang on. We'll answer this live on the air. Hello? 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 Damn it. See, potential spam doesn't want to answer the phone. Yes, Felice, there are several spots available on Studio B. Let's go over those right now. If you, like Felice, believe you have the gift for gab, head over to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, common spelling in your favorite internet browser, Freedom's Lips. There are a shit ton of open spots. Where'd everybody go? Where'd everybody go? Holy cow, there is literally, literally, where did everybody go? From 3 a.m. until at least 9 a.m., 7 days a week, 6 straight hours, come on, people! Get a show! Get a show! I want to do a round table one night with one of these people. I hear the round tables are very exciting. I want to create my own round table. Anybody with me? Can we create a round table? Let's say, when could I do it? Early Sunday morning, let's say 7 to 9 a.m. Sunday morning, round table with Mario and friends. But I don't have any friends, so who's on board? Who wants to do a round table with me from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Daylight Time on Sundays? We'll call it the shit show. It's all we'll do. Bad time. Which one is bad time of day? Which was the bad time of day? 7 to 9 a.m. is a bad time of day? No, not a Bigfoot round table. We'll mix it up. You can come, Mitzi. I want Pack Woman there. I want Pat Rabbit there. I want Christine C there. Right? That's what I want. So 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Sunday mornings. We'll call it. Mario and Friends. We'll call it Mitzi and Friends. Well, that's fine. That's fine, Mitzi. You're not doing anything else at 4 in the morning. Or are you? Or are you? All right, think about that, kids. I'm putting it out there. 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Sunday mornings. We'll talk about it on Thursday or message me on Skype. That's it. Have yourself a fabulous Monday evening. In the words of Katie Kirk, good night, y'all.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.